The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Good day, everyone, and welcome again to another edition of Boomer Generation Radio. This is your host, Richard Address, and we are coming to you, as usual, from the beautiful studios of WWDB AM 860 here in Greater Philadelphia and streaming live on the magic of the computer on WWDBAM.com. And as usual, if you want to reach us, you can friend us on the Boomer Generation Radio Facebook page and email us at boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. And we're going to be back with our first segment guests, that's easy for you to say, right after this word from our very good friends at Kendall.
Staff member Sheila Sylvester. This portion of Boomer Generation Radio was brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services in 8 states that advocates for and empowers older adults to reach their full potential. Please join us in Together Transforming the Experience of Aging. To learn more about Kendall, that's K-E-N-D-A-L, visit discoverkendall.org or call toll-free 888-759-0128.
Welcome back to Boomer Generation Radio here. Welcoming you again, WWDB here in Philly, AM 860, and streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And we are very, very pleased to welcome to the microphones here in studio our first guest for our first segment, Phil Schulman, a storyteller, artist, graphic designer, film director, raconteur, man about town, and Carol Moore Schulman, artist, writer, and a professor emerita. I have to get that word right, at the University of the Arts here in Philadelphia. Both artists, and we're going to talk a little bit about one of the themes that comes up a lot here on Boomer Generation Radio, and that is this whole idea of transitions from various types of work into new types of work. And I want to welcome you first, Carol and Phil, here to the show. Thank you very much for driving in and coming to visit us. And I look forward to just our conversations prior to going on air. There's so much richness here in your own lives. You're both artists. You both work in various areas where you're telling different types of stories. And as we were talking before we get into some of the transition stuff, I think it's very helpful and illuminating and in many ways energizing. Your own story, you were as 50-year-olds, right? What happened, Carol?
Thank you, Richard. Yeah, we met. I was 50. I had just been widowed a second time. And Phil was going through a divorce. He was 55. And we kind of kept each other at arm's length as much as we could. But 22 years later, here we are. And we just always had a lot to talk about. And we've been doing our own individual work and collaborating. Pardon me, ever since. So, in fact, the first year that we met, we did a radio commercial together, and that was one time when I actually did allow Phil to direct me.
So,
the last time, as a matter of fact.
Right. It's memorable, first and last. Right. Right. So was it, I imagine it was a very successful direction, and you figured why mess with success, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
That's very good. So, the work that you do and the transitions that you do, and as we were talking before, the work that you do as artists really speak to this. You're continually transitioning from stages of life to another, recording it for human beings, writing about it, speaking about it, directing. You're both involved in a huge amount of work here in the greater Philadelphia area around art. The initiative, the Senior Artist Initiative, something that's very, very fascinating. What is that? How did you get started in that? What do you do with that?
But let's talk about how it happened. Ann Kaplan lost her husband, Jerry Kaplan, who was both a teacher and a printmaker and a fine guy, and found herself inundated with years and years and years of Jerry's work. It took her a very long time to sort it out so she could begin to make decisions, decisions like, what would Jerry have wanted this work to do? Do I give it to a museum? Which of the work do the children get? Which do we keep? Which gets put into, how does it become part of the estate? She saw the need for senior artists to have answers to those questions. So what the Senior Artists Initiative does is help senior artists to first inventory their work, decide about the benefits of the estate planning, both aesthetic and financial. We then interview each of the artists so that there is a video that is shot and cut and then archived and seeable on our website, seniorartistinitiative.com. And that's how it got started. And Carol was honored by the University of the Arts, one of five or six local schools that
participate
each year. Mm-hmm. And students from the school do the filming, and the artists tell their story on how they have lived a life as an artist, and we intercut it with work so that there's a nice video profile that we wind up with.
Yeah. Go ahead, Carol.
Oh, I was just going to add that the SAI website now has about, what did we say, 90 plus Philadelphia artists, senior artists. So these are people who have been in the Philadelphia art scene for many years. And I think they're all artists that are 50 plus.
55 plus.
55 plus. So
what's the website, first of all? Because that may be of interest to a lot of people. What is the website?
Phil, you have that. It's the it's Senior Artists Initiative, SAI Philadelphia.
SAI.org.
Senior Artist Initiative.org.
Double check.
And so you have like 80, 90 artists, you say?
Yes. I mean, Philadelphia is rich with artists from all mediums, you know, painters, ceramicists, jewelry makers, sculptors, printmakers. So it's a great place for people to go to see how wealthy we are as a city in artists who have more than just local reputations.
And you're a professor emerita at U of Arts, okay?
Yes.
So you're still, though, involved with, if I'm not mistaken, with students?
Well, I advise thesis students, and I'm a visiting critic in the MFA Studio Art Program that I founded in 1994, along with my colleagues. I didn't do it alone. Wonderful, wonderful people at UArts, wonderful instructors and professors. It's just great, great artists. So I'm still involved there, but since my leaving UArts as a full-time professor, associate professor, I have been returned to my work in my studio full-time, developing projects that I had begun earlier. So now Phil and I are now working on another project, but
More transitions.
Yeah, well, I think as artists, in our personal lives and in our professional lives, as a creative individual, you're always adapting. You're challenging. You're questioning. You're recording existence, your own and others. But you're constantly adapting because life is about adapting. And questioning, and you're asking questions, you're responding to things, the stimuli. So I think for us, we've always had lives where we've transitioned from one thing to another, again, personally and professionally. So this is not much different.
You write it in one of the conversations before the show that aging is aging, yes, but doesn't have to be limiting. Do artists, do people who are artistic, if that's the right word, Do you sense that this group of individuals has a leg up on the ability of people to grow old without limitations? Does being an artist give you that insight? Because, Carol, you alluded to it. You're always, you know, trying to create, looking at something. You'll see something, you know, out there and say, ah, could this be a piece of art? Could this be? I mean, that's... Do people who are do artists have that leg up on people like me, you know, who aren't artists at all?
Probably yes, in that they can have that conversation with themselves whenever they'd like to. Mm-hmm. So I can sit down and draw or paint, or Carol can, and it doesn't really require anyone else. It doesn't require feedback, for that matter. It's just something in you have involved yourself, and you are satisfied with that involvement or not, because often we'll work and we'll look at it and we'll go, feh, that didn't come out well at all. You know, I really, I'm not going to keep this one. But it doesn't require other people, and it doesn't require necessarily an audience. There are artists, writers, for example, who do require an audience, because it's about the audience and the audience's acceptance of what's been written. Not to say that artists aren't interested in what their viewing audience might have to say, but they don't start out that way. They start out by feeling the need to put that mark on that canvas.
Does go ahead. I'm sorry, Gaira.
Oh, no. I just wanted to add to what Phil said, that I think that you don't make a choice to become an artist. It's something that develops in you. I think it is the way you are in the world. I think you know it from when you're young. And if you decide to stay with it, you find different avenues with which to use what you've got, what you're observing, and what you care about. Artists are passionate because they can be passionate about a wide range of things. I have one friend who has been passionate about gun control for years and years and years. She's talked about this, and she makes work about that. This is nothing new. She's been making work about the prevalence of violence in our society. Another friend who has a garden. Her entire life is about beauty and about what exists in nature. Her work is about that. Mine, I've been exploring, I guess one would say, the more existential kinds of things about life, how our lives go, the things that happen to us, the things we initiate. So I'm talking more about existence, and I'm also interested in, as I said earlier, women who have not been seen in the present, and I like to make them more visible. So I think we use our abilities and our vision to make these things happen, and we do need the audience. We want that feedback. But as Phil said initially, we're driven to express.
So a couple of follow-up questions. Number one, from what I'm sensing, you can't teach someone to be an artist. It has to be internal. You have to be you have to be born with that
I think
gene. I mean, you can't teach. If I walked in and say I want to be an artist, and I have very little talent in art.
Yes, you can be. I think that I think we all have the potential. People forget that making marks is one of the earliest pieces of language that children ever have.
Right.
And if we keep that in the forefront of our teaching, if we have children always making things, using their hands, making marks, making music, it's been proven time and again that kids that grow up making art, making music, doing creative activities, writing, they're the children that have a much broader vision about their world, and they do better academically. So don't get me started on taking art and music programs out of school.
That's a whole several hour conversation.
People forget that's the cultural basis of
humanity.
Yes, but I think that everyone has that potential to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
It's how it's developed and who is mentoring them.
So you talked a lot about the Senior Artist Initiative, and something, Phil, you also said about this wealth of talent. Does our own aging, do people who, in your experience looking back into your both of your careers, does that sense of perspective, life experience, years, add to the richness of one's art? Looking back on what's the work that you've done, is your work more profound, meaningful, deeper now than it was when you were 25, 35, or 45?
Well, that's a tough question.
Good.
Yes and no. Yes and no. I think that because of the experience that we have over time, we get to look at things differently. However, many artists will tell you that it's the child in you that you're trying to access. So Picasso was famous for saying that in his 90s, you know, that he was getting it. He was getting closer to the child in him, which he was hoping to access, because that was the real authentic self. So, yes, we have the wisdom of the age, but it doesn't necessarily produce better art.
We're speaking with Phil Shulman, a storyteller, artist, designer, director, and Carol Moore Shulman, who shares that sense of artistic talent, writer and professor emerita at the University of Arts here in Philly, here on Boomer Generation Radio. And we'll be back with Phil and Carol right after this word from our friends at Kendall.
Hi, this is Kendall resident Harry Hammond. This portion of Boomer Generation Radio is brought to you by Kendall. Founded on Quaker principles, Kendall provides independent living, assisted living, memory support, skilled nursing and rehabilitation care for older adults in 8 states. Whether you're looking for the intellectual and cultural stimulation of a college town or a big city, Kendall has a community for you. We are together transforming the experience of aging. To learn more, visit Kendall.org or call toll-free 888-759-0128.
Welcome back to our first segment here on Boomer Generation Radio today on WWDB AM 860 here in Philly, streaming live WWDBAM.com on Boomer Generation Radio with Carol Moore Shulman and Phil Shulman, artists, people about the world. You've done a lot of creative work, not only here in Philly and bringing artistic talent and showcasing it through the Artists Initiative. You've also been involved in some very interesting work around the world with projects, collaborative projects, if I'm not mistaken,
mm-hmm.
correct?
True.
Correct?
Yeah.
Carol, you mentioned the bringing women. You're involved now in this women's the Women Prophets Project, if I'm not mistaken. Right. Could you just, in a very brief way, just bring us up there? What is that about?
The Knesset Israel,
the synagogue in Elkins
synagogue
Park,
in Elkins Park, invited artists to respond to the work of Jacob Landau's 40-year commemoration of his stained glass windows in the sanctuary. Rabbi Lance Sussman invited the artists to come, and we all met in the sanctuary, and we talked about all of the male prophets that Landau had illustrated in his stunning stained glass windows. However, there was only one woman who was a sacred prostitute. There were no women represented, and I said, "Where are all the women?" And this has to do with my two previous projects that Phil and I have worked on, which is about bringing unknown or obfuscated women to contemporary audiences. So I said, I think I want to do a project that will bring women of the Bible, prophets, or women with prophetic quests to contemporary audiences, particularly to young women and their families, to learn more about them, to make them more visible. So I've illustrated 12 women in a portfolio. I've written text where each woman is speaking to us, and Phil has been the art director designing the portfolio, and we're about to, we have a press called Laughing Contessa Press, and we're about to publish that, I think, within the next month, we're hoping. My two previous projects have been involved with bringing the work of women poets of the Italian Renaissance to contemporary audiences.
So that's, you did that in Rome, right?
Yes, we did two major projects. I had a residency at the American Academy in Rome, so Phil and I went. We did research. We actually did a pilgrimage. I was on sabbatical. And we did a pilgrimage where we went to the cities, and in some cases the churches and the castle, the workplace where several of these women poets lived, ending up in Venice, where the book that I had, the first book I had completed with Phil, became part of the National Marciana Library in Venice, and we did an installation there. We came back 2 years later. The library director, Marino Zorzi, told us, his family had been there since the 1200s, that we said, well, in our trek through central and northern Italy, people don't know about these women poets. And he said, unfortunately, no one comes into the library except scholars. So he said, I would love to have people come into the library. So we came back. I had a vision, a dream about one of the poets walking down the street, dropping her handkerchief, and on it was written one of her poems. And so we began designing in Italian and English handkerchiefs that we then went back to Venice with in 2005. And left them around the Biennale and around Venice so people would find them and keep them. And we had an exhibition in the library. Also, we had gone to the Victoria and Albert Museum.
In London.
Yes, where they acquired my earliest book, the one that was at the National.
The fan book is in Alexandria. It's in the V&A in London. It's here in Bryn Mawr. Is it Wellesley.
So, Phil, you, as Carol said, you are the art director on some of these, and part of your bio, before we start running out of time, yeah. I have to ask you this, because you alluded to it when we were talking before we went on air. You were in ad agencies, art directors, right? In supposedly the heyday. So I'm going to ask you this on the air. I ask you this beforehand. So you watch Mad Men. You were part of that
era.
Right. And
I was very young at the time.
Of course. I know. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. When you watched that show, what bubbled up in your own feeling?
Well, there were a bunch of things that resonated, you know, and I couldn't help, as an ad guy and a filmmaker, to go, wait a minute, you can't be handling that much business with only two art directors, you know, that kind of thing. No, we didn't drink in the building that I remembered ever. We drank at lunch.
What about the women? Yeah.
What do you mean? What about the women?
Remember, this is live.
I'm not going to name names. No, I'm sorry.
I should tell you that. Remember, it's live.
That's right. I was, you know, part of that era, but AIR wasn't quite the agency that was painted on that show.
But I imagine it kind of made you giggle a little bit every once in a while.
Sure.
So you work together a lot. Obviously, you've talked the handkerchief project, the women profits project, a bunch of other the senior initiative.
Right.
You're this ad couple.
Ted Regan and I. Yeah.
So how do you handle? You're both creative people.
Right. Okay?
You both are directors. You're both used to, you know, like developing something and watching it grow and seeing it to fruition. How do you work together? How do you manage that delicate dance, I call it, of relationship?
And we even cook together.
That is.
Yeah. No, I think that part for me, collaboration was something that I always enjoyed, so that in the advertising business, you learn to collaborate. I mean, you had to, because as charged as an art director, you had to communicate to illustrators, photographers, people who were going to tell the story for you with their tools. Mm-hmm. And you learn to collaborate. You learn to respect other good, creative people. And it's a pleasure collaborating.
Yeah, I think we know how to give each other. We know what's required in terms of how much time one needs working alone.
Mm-hmm.
I know. And we each, I have a studio. Phil has his studio office. We meet for meals. We prepare meals together. We're happy to see each other. Not all the time, but sometimes we can get cranky like anybody else about, you know, this isn't working out for me, or you're not understanding me, I'm not understanding you. But I think, you know, coming together later in life like we did, and we're just incredibly appreciative, and we've had to manage a lot. I have two sons. Phil has two daughters. They're all grown and, you know, have their own lives.
And now we have Ted.
Now we have four kids and their families, grandchildren, wonderful grandchildren. So we are
a 100-year-old father.
Father's going to be 100 in 2 weeks.
Happy birthday, Mazel Tov.
Yeah.
Really.
So we know how to give each other space, because we know that's what we individually require.
Right.
Last question before we have to end this segment. And again, thank you very much for coming and being our guest here. Guest here on Boomer Generation Radio. Responding to both of your artistic souls, is it ever too late for somebody to tap into that reservoir of creativity?
Never.
If somebody walked up to you and said, you know, I'm 80 years old, I've always wanted to do this, but look, I can't get around much anymore. What would you say to them?
Here, sit down. Pick up this pencil.
Exactly. I was just going to say the same thing.
Wow.
Just say, would you like to do blind drawing? And I would give them, we would say, let's start doing this. And I think just when we do something that comes from us, that is so self-empowering. I don't care whether you're a huge professional or whether you're just sitting there observing and want to make something. It's wonderful.
It's like Ted and I.
Right.
So we met working on a project. We knew each other from 40 years ago, and now we can't work together enough.
Carol Moore Schulman and Phil Schulman, thank you very much for sharing your humanity and your creativity and your artistic souls with us. And hopefully one day we'll have you back, and continued good luck. And the SAI.org, that Senior Artist Initiative here in Philadelphia, that's great stuff. And keep up the good work. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for being our guest here on Boomer Generation Radio. Thank you very much. We want to bring you another message of very good friend of ours, Peter Hecht and the Hecht Investment Group of Janney Montgomery Scott, which provides concierge financial consulting and planning services. Peter and his group use a formal investment process as their foundation, and clients receive frequent communication and rapid response to questions. And as many of us know, there are no needs greater than our own when it comes to personal financial planning, especially in this rather volatile environment. The Hecht Investment Group provides experienced guidance as well as an efficient management process that is important in today's environment. Additionally, Peter Hecht and his team can assist you in connecting to the investment banking department, which specializes in assisting middle market companies achieve their strategic goals. We invite you to contact the Hecht Investment Group toll-free at 855-289-2168 or visit them at hechtinvestmentgroup.com. That's H-E-C-H-T. The HechtInvestmentGroup.com. They're also on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Janney Montgomery Scott is a member of the New York Stock Exchange, FINRA, and SIPC. And Peter has asked me to remind you that they're holding one of their regularly scheduled frequent forums for clients, etc. This Thursday, October the 15th, at the Harvest Seasonal Grill and Wine Bar at the Morristown Mall. That's 400 Route 38 in Morristown, New Jersey. Dealing with taking charge of one's own health, optimizing your diet through healthy eating Eating Habits with Bonnie Duboff, a registered dietitian. So that's Thursday, October the 15th. If you give the Hecht Investment Group a call at that number, 855-289-2168, you can probably sneak in and learn a little bit more about healthy eating and wellness. And we're going to be back with our second guest, Elliot Strom, and part of his transition into published author and novelist. Right after our usual break in between segments, we'll do a little classic 1960s rock and roll.
Money can buy me love. I'll give you all I've got to give if you say you love me too. I may not have a lot to give, but what I got, I'll give to you. I don't care too much for money. The money can buy me love, can buy me love. Everybody tells me so.
Hi, this is Kendall staff member Sheila Sylvester. This portion of Boomer Generation Radio is brought to you by Kendall. Founded on Quaker principles, Kendall provides independent living, assisted living, memory support, skilled nursing, and rehabilitation care for older adults in 8 states. Whether you're looking for the intellectual and cultural stimulation of a college town or a big city, Kendall has a community for you. We are together transforming the experience of aging. To learn more, visit Kendall.org or call toll-free 888-759-0128.
Welcome back to the second segment of Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDBAM.com. Our streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And we are pleased to welcome, hopefully I can hear him, Elliot Strom. Elliot, are you there?
Good morning, Richard. How
hey.
Are you?
Hey. Okay, this is work. This, having a little trouble with the headphones here. So I think I can hear you well. With a little technical issue here in studio.
Anyway, I can hear you well.
Great.
But I always hear you well.
All right. Let's watch it, Strom. Anyway, the book, Rabbit Run, Rabbi Run. See, I'm already channeling my John Updike.
Yes, indeed.
Elliot Strom left a congregational rabbinate after many, many decades to follow a dream, I would imagine. We've been talking a lot about today issues of transition. We've talked a lot about transitioning over those last several years here on Boomer Generation Radio. And that's why I wanted to talk to you. This is when was the book published, Elliot?
This last June.
Okay. So the first obvious question is, tell me your story, Elliot, about what motivated you to move from a very successful career as a clergyman and now into a rather different environment of sitting down, writing a novel, getting it published, and just getting it out there. Tell me that story of your journey.
Well, the first thing to say is that I loved my work, and I really loved my work. Early in my life, I didn't know quite what I was going to end up doing and had different ideas, thought I might go into academics, thought I might go into law. And when I looked around at my career years into it, I thought, no, this is exactly what I was meant to do. I couldn't be happier, I'm certain, doing anything else. So it was never a question of, I don't like my work, I can't wait to retire from it. But it was a sense of, there is something unique about being a rabbi, I'm certain, about being a clergy person of whatever faith. But the idea of the life is that it is it expands infinitely to fill the hours in the day, because there's so many human needs that no matter how much we respond to them, there's still more we could be doing. So what it meant for me was, while it was a kind of life that in many ways may have looked like an attorney's life or like an accountant's life or in some ways even an entertainer's life, there was something unique about this job that I always thought, this is what I think people are curious about. They wonder what it's like to be the rabbi, and I wanted to write a story that would give a look at the inside out. What does it feel like? What does it look like from the rabbi's point of view? And Richie, frankly, I started on this more than a dozen years ago. I wrote only when I had uninterrupted time, which was sabbatical time, and I thank my congregation for that. But if I had a few months here and a few months there, and then I waited 6 or 7 years, it was a long-term project. And I realized that this was something that was dear to me. I was deeply involved in it and wanted to come to the end of the process and finish the writing and be proud of the book. So in addition to some other issues as well, it seemed like a good time a couple of years ago to go away from the full-time work that I'd been doing there for 35 years and allow myself to do part-time some of the same things that I always love, but to find more time for other things, including this book.
So tell me about David. David is the character, the main character in Rabbi Run. Tell me about him.
So he is a flawed character. He is hungry to learn and really a serious spiritual seeker. And he loves being a rabbi, at least at the beginning of the book. He loves the rabbi's life, and he is very popular, and his folks love him. But he kind of runs onto the shoals. He gets himself in a great deal of trouble because he, number one, I think because he doesn't have the parameters, the boundaries that he would have to have, because he always put his professional life above his personal life. So his marriage is a real issue. His relationship with his only child, a teenage son, is very problematic. And he keeps falling into traps that are sometimes set by others, and most of the time they are set by himself. And so he gets himself into a real jackpot. And the story of the book is, on the one hand, I hope sympathy for him that he's trying to make his relationships work and he's trying to find some kind of spirituality for himself and he's trying to do a good job, but he keeps running into one problem after another. And I guess, you know, if everything worked out perfectly for him, it wouldn't be much of a story. It's only when people kind of get themselves into trouble that we all of a sudden get pulled in. And I hope and think that the reader gets pulled into his story, because it is, I hope, a really compelling one.
No, it's a very – I really enjoyed reading the book, so I really have to congratulate you. And let's get to the nitty-gritty right away. Somebody wants to get a hold of Rabbi Run by Elliot Strom. Elliot, how do they get it?
Okay, so just go on to Amazon on the net, and you either look for Rabbi – it's Rabbi, Run – or look for my name, Elliot Strom, and you will find it on either. And if you are a tablet person, it's on Kindle as well. Thank you for asking and allowing me to say that.
Oh, no, the more the merrier. What's the metaphor or the symbolism of the running? Because the book, he meets his wife, is running, and the last sentence of the book takes us back to that. What's the symbolism of the run?
Well, the symbolism of the run is, on the one hand, through his career, he is, like any clergy that I know, literally always on the run. He is moving from one activity to another and trying to focus on the moment and be there and respond to people and be aware and alive and awake to the moment while he is running literally from one event to another, which is a challenge. He's also somebody who loves to run, literally. He's a runner who gets his personal private place where he can think and look for something beyond himself while he's running. So he does that. As you said, he meets his wife at a charity run early in the book. And most of all, I think it's meant to raise the question of, is he more than just running, but is he sometimes running away from? Because you can see his relationship with his wife is fraught, and it seems to her that he is running from him. She, by the way, they alternate chapters through a great deal of the book, and we get her point of view as well. And she is frustrated with how he seems to be always on the run and running from her. He seems to be running from all of his serious relationships. He's afraid, I think, of getting in too deep. And at the end, there's really a question about where does he want to be? Does he want to be with family, community, with friends, or is he more inclined to run off on his own somewhere? So the issue of running, you know, you said at the beginning, rabbit run, which is an easy mistake to make because that's exactly what it's about. The title of the book clearly is it's a play on Rabbit Run by John Updike.
Right.
And at the beginning, when the title came to me, it was almost in the category of a joke, a play on words, something that would be punny and memorable. Isn't that cute? But number one, I started thinking maybe it isn't cute at all, but maybe it's saying something. And the more I came to understand the character, the more I thought it really is about his running in all of those senses. And the question at the end of the book is, where has his running taken him to, and where will his running take him to now?
Just to talk a little bit of biblical text, if we may, the running aspect, the running away, he's running away, he's running from, he's rarely running to anything. How much, in a way, is subliminally came into your thinking the book of Jonah and this character of Jonah from the Bible who runs away?
Well, I think that there's elements of Jonah for sure, and really he is the ultimate story of the one who is afraid of, is uncomfortable with, flees from his God-given responsibility. So I can't say that it was conscious, but I am certain it was unconscious. And part of it is, and this part was a little bit more conscious, there's a wonderful text talking about Abraham, where he is told to lech lecha, which on one level just means, it's lech means go, and so lech lecha is making it stronger, really get going, get moving. But the rabbis, of course, because the rabbis love to play with the language, say it means run to yourself, for yourself, in a sense run to discover yourself. And I'm hoping that there's elements here where David in the novel is not running away from, but in some sense is running to try and understand who he is. And I'm hoping that it seems to the reader at the end that he's come to some self-discovery. Maybe lech lecha, he really has run to himself while he's running away from so many other things.
We're speaking with Elliot Strom, the author of this brand new book, just published in over the summer, Rabbi Run, available on Amazon. And for those of you who prefer to read electronically as opposed to pages, available on Kindle and all that electronic stuff. And you're listening to Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDB AM 860 here in Philadelphia and streaming live on WWDBAM.com. We'll be back with Elliot to pursue some of these other, we're going to run with some other issues right after these words from our friends at Kendall.
Hi, this is Kendall resident Harry Hammond. This portion of Boomer Generation Radio is brought to you by Kendall Outreach. Kendall Outreach serves the field of aging by raising public awareness of important health care issues of older adults, and it provides education and training in the development and implementation of comprehensive approaches to safe, individualized, long-term care practices. Kendall Outreach has been sharing Kendall's approaches to quality care with consumers, advocates, providers, government agencies, and related organizations since 1989. To learn more, visit KendallOutreach.org.
Welcome back to Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDB AM 860 and WWDBAM.com. Elliot Strom, the author of Rabbi Run, just published over the summer, available on Amazon and Kindle and all that good electronic millennial stuff, which I really shouldn't say because I do it myself. Elliot, before we took that little break, you're talking about, again, the symbolism of running and the main character, David, who at the end continues to run and hopefully running towards himself. It raises the question as a clergy person, that also hit me while I was reading the book, because it's any clergy person is going to identify with David in a variety of different ways, and he or she is going to identify with the characters in the congregation because they're universal characters, as many of us know. In your experience as a congregational rabbi, as an author now, looking as an artist, which is what you are, looking at the bigger picture, and with clergy people, do you sense, as David may have been doing, that he's running to some sort of, or desires of some sort of spiritual awakening? In other words, do clergy people in just the running of keeping up with everything day to day, do they lose that sense of seeking a spiritual meaning?
I think that there are a lot of pressures that ironically draw the clergy away from exactly what is the heart and soul of being a spiritual leader of a congregation. There are so many demands that go into the work that rabbis are pulled in every direction, pulled towards the business aspect, pulled towards the membership aspect, pulled towards the media aspect, and the practical running of the building that the synagogue is housed in. All of those things, if the rabbi doesn't have some kind of familiarity with those things, they won't always go at optimum. So the pull is there all the time, away from exactly what is the meat of, I hope, of any rabbi's life. In the book, there's an episode in which a congregant has a conversation with him and says, you know, I see you less as Rabbi Chazen, his last name, Chazen. I see you less as Rabbi Chazen and more as the CEO of Temple Emmanuel, Inc.
Right.
And that's exactly the danger, one that I think any clergy can identify with. And if you get pulled in that direction to the exclusion, to the distraction of the center of it all, which is Torah, which is study, which is spirituality, prayer, some kind of seeking after something larger than ourselves, seeking after God, if you lose that because you're trying to run an efficient operation along with your lay leaders, then there's nothing left. You're a husk, you're a shell that looks good on the outside and where you don't have the spark any longer inside. So I think that's exactly David's struggle. He doesn't want to give into that. He's getting pulled into that, and he knows if he just plays by the rules, He won't run into trouble. But if he plays by the rules, he's not going to have what drew him into the rabbit in the first place, which is the spiritual dimension. So he makes, you can see him getting pulled into the to being that CEO figure, and then he resists. He pulls back, and Rich, as you know, when he pulls back, when he says, I'm not going to play that game anymore, he gets himself into a major jackpot.
So talk to me about the two major female characters that play in this book, the Sharon, Kelly. What was your take on that? What was your motivation? How did you arrive at them and their roles? And what are they? Go ahead.
There are two women in this book that really are poles for him. One is his wife, and she is, I think, a fascinating person. I think that she pulls us to see her side of the story. You know, this is a point-counterpoint almost. You're reading his story and you're reading her story. And her story, she'll tell you the same events that he's already described, but she'll tell them very differently. So she is, on the one hand, I think, somebody who gives you a reality check on the first-person narrative of the rabbi himself. He tells you how things are going. She gives you a different point of view. But what you get from her is how her husband promised her that she would be first in his life, and you can see she doesn't feel that that's so, and we kind of are inclined to see it her way. And one of the things that is, for me, so important in this book is an understanding for congregants, community folks, and clergy to remember that if you don't have that sacred space at home, if you don't have that solid relationship with your wife, and of course with your children, that you can't be much good to anybody. That's your strength. That's what allows you to help other people through difficult moments and celebrate at great moments, is you've got that foundation in your family. And you can see, especially from her point of view, but even from him, inadvertently, you know that it's not what it should be. So that's the one pull, and her dissatisfaction and where that takes her, which is a pretty, I think, difficult story, but an important one. And on the other hand, he's got a girlfriend. She is just a colleague. She's not a love interest at the beginning, but she is someone who shares his love for the rabbinate and who has so many of the same values with him. But he feels himself getting pulled into an inappropriate relationship with her, and especially because his relationship at home with his wife is not so good. And that pulls him into very dangerous territory. You can kind of get a sense that his feet have found some quicksand, and that he's kind of getting sucked into something that, he is going to pay a price for. So those are the two women in his life, and they pull him to, I guess you would say, where he ought to be and where he very much ought not be, and he is pulled back and forth. Where he ends up is, of course, the story of the book.
And he winds up, and I think we've alluded to the end of the book. He winds up making a major career change at the end of the book.
Oh, well, you've given it away.
Well, you know, we sort of like all gave it away. But the question that really concerned me was I was reading through the book. Is at what point did David, or in your writing of David, did he on a subconscious level make the decision way before he decided to do this? And do people do that? Do people set themselves up for an action that may take years and years away, but if you look back on a logical plane, they've really set themselves up for this?
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful question, Rich, and I think that it was always in my mind that from the beginning of the story, he's a bit of a round peg in a, no, it's right, a round peg in a
square hole, right?
He doesn't, he can play the role, but in terms of what he really wants and who he really is inside, there's a fundamental disjunct. It doesn't really work the way it should. And I think he knows that from early on. He's very successful at what he does, but there's almost a sense with him of kind of play acting to make it work. And when he realizes who he is and what he needs to do, he understands that the fit is not so good. And it's almost like he can't bring himself to make a separation. He can't do that in a number of areas in his life. But I think you could argue that in every area of his life where he knows that it can be fixed, then he acts in a way that ultimately allows it to be fixed. And where he believes that it's not possible to be fixed, whether he realizes it or not, and I'm inclined to believe that he's unaware, but boy, is he doing it. He is setting up again and again a way where he won't be able to fix it because he has already walked away from it. And the running is part of that, is where he sees that where he understands instinctively that it just maybe can't ever be set right. You can just see him building a wall one brick at a time where he sets it all up at the end for him to separate. I think it's a wonderful question. And I think we all do that.
If 5 years later you were able to look in on where David Chazen is he a happy guy, or is he still filled with regret? Or am I giving away the sequel?
That's where I was going. The next project, you know, I know so much of what your show is about is transitions. For me, this is an opportunity, in addition to all the other things that I love doing in my life and still doing lots of things with my wonderful congregation, Shiramee in Newtown, and keeping busy in a variety of ways. But for me, this is a chance to go back and write a follow-up book, and I am already sketching out where it goes. But that's exactly where I intend to go next, is in a year, in 2 years, in 5 years, where does he go and what does he do? I can't wait to follow him up. I can't wait to see. To a certain extent, Rich, these are things that I know in advance, but I would think like any writer, no matter how much you may have it structured and planned, it takes on a life of its own. This book surely did. So I think I know where he's going next. But I'm going to have to read the book myself to find out.
Well, Elliot, that's good luck with that. Once again, Elliot, tell everybody where they can pick up a copy of Rabbi Run.
Okay. Rabbi Run is available on Amazon online. It's available on Kindle if you prefer the tablet way of reading. And I would love not only to know that there are readers out there, but to hear from you and to discuss the book, because I think it raises so many important issues, as well as, I hope, telling a pretty compelling story.
Yeah, I could see actually, especially in within our community, in the Jewish community, I could see this being a book club, a synagogue book club read, because it touches on, I would imagine, some very interesting conversations of lay rabbinic relationships, and also just clergy, and, you know, whether you're a minister, a priest, or a rabbi, an imam, these are some universal issues here about the dynamics of what happens within a congregation. So I want to thank you again, Elliot, for giving us your time to be a guest here on Boomer Generation Radio. Continued good luck with Rabbi Run. I wish it's a really good read, and I do recommend it. And good luck with crafting David's second phase of David's life. Good luck. I'm very anxious to see who he winds up with, if he winds up with anybody at all. And I thank you very much. Regards to the family. Good luck with your Blue Jays. I had to sneak that in. And just,
we're praying.
Yeah, well,
I believe in the efficacy of prayer.
Yeah, I believe in the efficacy of a good fastball. Anyway, listen, take care. Regards to everybody, to all of you. Thank you for joining us on Boomer Generation Radio. Have a great week. Stay safe. We'll see you here next week on Boomer Generation Radio, same time and same station. Take care.